astronauts will exercise anywhere from, 3 to 8 hours a day to maintain their muscle mass. And these bears are not exercising at all, and yet they're maintaining their muscle mass. And they're doing that without eating or drinking.
You are listening to Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories, a podcast about surgeon scientists, the things they care about,
and why it matters to you.
We're not superhuman.
You don't have time to specialize in both things at once.
The more I learned about it, the more I recognized that this needed to be brought to the forefront.
When you get a bad outcome, how do you manage your own emotions?
That feeling that you get when the patients say thank you, that's why I do it.
Join the conversation. This is Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories. Hello, I'm David for the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery. Believe it or not, the black bear may hold the key to important medical breakthroughs, from protecting vulnerable transplant tissues to improving ICU care and even getting humans to Mars? Dr. Paul Izzo is a physiologist in the Department of Surgery and the director of the Visible Heart Lab at the University of Minnesota. For over 2 decades, Dr. Izzo has been collaborating with a team of biologists studying what hibernating black bears can teach us about the human body. While Dr. Izzo's main focus is cardiovascular physiology, this research has also generated a lot of biological knowledge about the bears themselves and their changing relationship with the human world.
Bears are amazing animals. They can hibernate for 4 to 6 months. They don't eat, drink, defecate, or urinate during that period of time. And they're releasing all kinds of factors and hormones and bile acids, and they have high levels of circulating fatty acids. And we've actually looked at these agents as potential preconditioning agents. These agents have been used in Eastern medicine for thousands of years for treating all kinds of different conditions, including cardiovascular problems.
So the bear research over the course of 20 years has actually led to compounds that are now used with patients?
Right.
Medicinally? So
just the bear research in general, we started off not looking at the heart at all. We started looking at muscle mass. And I got basically interested in this because I had been studying muscle function in patients in the intensive care unit. And in the intensive care unit, if someone has multi-organ failure, septic type reactions, they can get in these hypercatabolic states, which means that they can catabolize or eat their own muscle mass, and they can lose up to 50% of their own muscle mass in a 2 to 3 week period of time. And if this occurs, typically they end up on a ventilator. If this occurs, then they probably have less than a 50% chance of ever coming off the ventilator. So the clinical outcome in the picture is not good. And the problem with these situations in the intensive care unit, it's really hard to understand what's the cause of the weakness and what are the contributing factors. For example, just immobilization in itself, we know is bad for patients. If you just have a cast and you're in a total healthy state, you're going to lose muscle mass just by immobilization of that one limb. Now you've got a whole body immobilized for weeks or months. So that immobilization, you're going to lose muscle mass. So we're studying muscle force in this and presented all this kind of work, published all this in neuromuscular disorders. And then one day I'm sitting in my office and I get a call out of the blue. And on the call, it's, hello, this is Professor Hank Harlow. I've been reading your publications. I'm very excited about your work on neuromuscular disorders and weakness and the progression of weakness. How would you like to study a population of individuals that show no weakness even though they're immobilized for 4 to 6 months? I said, well, that'd be fantastic. And he said, well, I'm studying hibernating black bears. And I said, well, that'd be fantastic. I'm from Minnesota. I love the outdoors. So basically, that's how the collaboration started.
So the professor who called you is actually a biologist.
He's a zoologist, animal physiologist. And so he actually studies exotic animals around the world. And so we basically, I went out there. I took my force assessment systems for humans. They actually had a black bear and a grizzly bear that I was able to do a necropsy on. look at all the anatomy. We designed a force device for bears, went out in the field, got funding from National Science Foundation and NASA, and we studied muscle force. And then we really showed that they weren't losing any skeletal-muscle mass during this 4 to 6 week period of time, where if you were a human, first off, you wouldn't make it beyond 3 days without drinking water. You wouldn't make it beyond 30 to 40 days without eating. And if you're immobilized, just, you know, crazy to think of. And yet these bears were going 4 to 6 months without doing any of that. And losing muscle mass at any time you could arouse a bear and they could defend themselves. And they have predators naturally out west, which is where we started, Colorado and Wyoming, which are cougars. And here in Minnesota, it's wolves. And so they have to be able to arouse and defend themselves. So we looked at the muscle mass, really showed they really weren't losing any strength during this hibernation period. Then the question is, well, what's happening to the heart? And at that period of time, Dr. Tim Lasky, who did his PhD in my lab, and he was working at Medtronic, begged to get involved in the bear research. He had done his undergrad in wildlife biology. And so then we started collaborating on all the cardiovascular aspects. Started doing 12-lead EKGs, echocardiographs. I probably have done over 1,000 echoes on bears in the wild and EKGs. And then we started implanting patient monitors, which are typically used to look at patients that have systolic events or, you know, their fainting spells or arrhythmias. They'll put in these loop recorders. So we've started implanting these in bears, and we've collected a plethora of really unique data and having new insights what these bears are doing that's very different than humans.
So you mentioned that some of the funding was coming from the government, such as the National Science Foundation and then, of course, NASA, which is very intriguing. I think some people might be curious to know, so how does this research translate in ways that NASA would care about?
Yeah, if you think of long-term space travel, one of the things they got to do is preserve muscle mass and cardiovascular health. And, you know, one of the things that they do now on the space station, so astronauts will exercise anywhere from, you know, 3 to 8 hours a day to maintain their muscle mass. And these bears are not exercising at all, and yet they're maintaining their muscle mass. And they're doing that without eating or drinking. Now, if you could think of sending someone to Mars and you've got multi-year travel, that means they're going to have to exercise every day for that those number of hours to maintain muscle mass, not only to get to Mars, but to get back. And so just the caloric input that's needed is phenomenal versus what these bears are doing.
So that's just, you need all those calories in space just to maintain the mass that you already have,
right?
Let alone put on new mass.
Right.
Now, this is really far out there, and I'm purely speculating here, but perhaps they may even figure out some way to put humans into hibernation for such a trip.
Yeah.
Of course, travel to Mars is quite far off anyway, so that's all speculative anyway. Right. But in general, I think this idea that this research also applies to current space travel, the idea of helping astronauts understand how and why, you know, their muscles respond the way that they do. Has any of that research yielded any kind of supplements that astronauts actually can use as well, or is this still more in the early stages?
This is still in the early stages, but you could think better how this might apply to a patient in the ICU, the intensive care unit. So a lot of these bear factors, when we think of them, some of them are delta opioid in nature, so that means they're analgesic. They also induce a state of sedation, and they also prevent damage to the vital organs. So this could be like the wonder drug for that ICU patient, because typically they're sedated. Typically you're giving pain management. Typically you're trying to protect all the vital organs, and you don't want them to lose any skeletal muscle mass. So I think this has more of a better opportunity for short-term benefits, and that's kind of where we're focusing our interest and our research.
Excellent. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the research itself. Mm-hmm. How do you work with bears in the wild? I mean, what does this kind of research entail? What does it look like?
Yeah, it's amazing. Even, you know, if we think the advances of technology, since I've been doing this in 20 years, that's changed a lot. So basically now there are collars that are satellite collars, and that's we actually work now with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Dr. Dave Garshelis, who's been the leader of the Bear Project for the last 35 years. So we've got the world bear expert on conservation of bears to collaborate with here in Minnesota, which is amazing. We've got Dr. Tim Lasky and now Dr. Tenen Isles. So you've got four individuals that come in it from all different areas. So again, Dave's a conservation biologist, Tim's a biomedical engineer, Tenen did her PhD in bioinformatics and computational biology, and I'm a human physiologist. And so we all are looking at this picture a slightly different, but the technology now with satellite collars, and we have over 35 bears in Minnesota with satellite collars, means that you can use Google Maps. Every 10, 15 minutes, you can pinpoint where they are within about 10 feet. And basically, you can look at maps of where they move in the environment. We have implanted those data loggers in there, which we can look at their cardiac function. We can look at their temperatures. We can look at their motions and their impedances over time. So you can look at all that continuously. And you can download that several times a year. And then you can actually, for example, see how the bears interact with humans, how they interact with predators, how they hibernate, how they deal with birthing and everything else.
I mean, this is generating a massive amounts of data of other types for the Department of Natural Resources, et cetera.
And so one of the interesting projects that we did recently is now that you have a cardiac monitor in the bears and you know their exact position, Mark Dittmer was one of the postdocs that worked for Dave and I, took drones, went to the GPS locations, flew the drone over top of the bear with a camera, visualized the bear. The bears would look up and didn't really respond, took the drone away. Then we'd look at their data afterwards and found that their heart rates were elevated for 10, 15 minutes.
Just from a drone flight
for seconds over the animal.
So this gives us a lot of insight, I think, in general about how animals may respond to human activity in ways that we can't see.
Right, and then we've looked at road crossings, so you can see where roads are. You can see how they respond to getting up to a road where there's cars crossing.
So can you tell that they know that they're coming up on a road? It's not like they're just, oh, I'm at a road, I'm reacting. So they remember things in the environment and they react.
They do. And then the latest thing that, of course, they're working, we have an active hunting season in Minnesota. There's about 15,000 bears. They have an annual hunting season here. We're actually, Dave is working with hunters to look where they put their baits, where we can track where these bears go and how they interact with bear.
I assume that you don't want the bears with your data monitoring equipment hunted. So that was going to be actually a question I was going to ask next is, with a bear hunt, how do you make sure that the hunters get the right kind of bear?
Yeah, so there's no way of avoiding that. So we have lost bears to hunters. They do have the collar on them. They do have ear tags. Every hunter has education not to shoot collared bears with the ear tags, but often they can't visualize that when they're hunting and accidents do occur.
Yeah, so are there any side effects for the bears themselves from this research?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, the beauty of the technology is now we can answer that. So we do go to the den, we'll approach the bear, we'll drug them, we'll then remove them from their den, study all their physiology, and put them back in their dens. And what's very interesting is that they can detect us coming from 50 to 100 feet away. They change their...
Even when they're asleep?
When they're asleep, when they're hibernating. They'll actually respond differently. Their heart rates will go up as if we are a predator. And then basically we will drug them. We'll actually knock out their hibernation behavior with the drugs. And then we can detect within 3 hours after we leave the den, the drugs wear off, they go back into deep hibernation like nothing happened. And so we really are haven't affected any of these bears' abilities at all. And actually, most of the bears in the study are well in their teens or 20-year-old bears. Because of the hunt, the average age of a bear in Minnesota is 5 to 6 years. And our bears that are in study, there is an advantage to being in the study because they do have the collars. They're living a lot longer than the average bear in Minnesota.
Now, you mentioned in addition to the collars that there is also some sort of an implantable device.
Right.
I was wondering if there was any, I mean, the bears are living pretty long, but I was wondering if there's any issues, you know, with the bears having the permanent device implanted.
Yeah, so actually they did have foreign body responses to them, and they did reject some of these devices, the larger size ones. First, we started with defibrillator can size devices. That was back in 2000, and we did a number of those. They rejected those, which was unexpected. If you put a defibrillator can in a human, a dog, a sheep, pig, calf, whatever, animal model, they'll stay until you pull them out. Bears were different. We didn't anticipate that at all. And so they have this active foreign body response. And then you think about it and it makes sense. So if they go into a den with a foreign body, if they don't put all their energy to reject that foreign body, they'd be septic and dead. So they have this foreign body response. So then we went to the next generation devices, which took a number of years, and that's about the size of a thumb drive, and that's the Medtronic Reveal device. And we had variable foreign body responses to those devices. And what was intriguing is in some of the animals, they'd stay in for years and then reject them. And so it was never predictable. And the latest one is the Medtronic Reveal Link device, which is an injectable device. It's about the size of 2 matchsticks. And you inject that under the skin, and they really haven't had any foreign body response to them. And yet these batteries can last 3 to 5 years in these devices. They've added Bluetooth technology to them. And so our goal is to be able to have radio collars that will then have receivers for the Bluetooth, cell phones on there, charging systems on there, and remotely having these bears call us up and send their data to us. And we're collaborating with groups in Yellowstone and Alaska to be able to put such devices on grizzly bears. And we've actually implanted the Reveal's Link devices at the University of Washington with Dr. Charlie Robbins and his team. And they actually have captive grizzly bears, and they're actually looking at all their metabolic functions, but they can also assess their behaviors. So then we're looking at behavioral responses and cardiovascular changes.
One question people might have is a question that I have swirling around in the back of my head is, of course, you're a human physiologist, as you said. Yep. And you said that when you first started this research, you needed to explore some bear anatomy. Mm-hmm. So how different are they? Did you have to spend a lot of time learning some new animal anatomy, or are things pretty similar from your point of view?
It's amazing, very similar. And actually, you can hear often quotes from hunters that if you skin a bear and you look at that whole body, it looks very human-like with the musculature and all the anatomy that way. The heart anatomy, there have been bears that have been euthanized or shot that then they've actually donated bear hearts to the lab, and we actually have plastinized those as well. And they're a little bit larger, and their inside anatomy is a little bit different. Walls are thicker, less trabeculation, but overall 4 chambers, similar cardiac anatomies.
I mean, who would have thought that bears of all animals would be so similar anatomically for the purposes of your work?
Yep.
Is there anything else that you would like people to know about the work that you're doing with bears and where it's going next?
We could continue on for quite a while. It's such exciting anatomy that they're doing, unique behaviors. One of the things that they'll do is that with this immobilization, for example, There's no emboli, there's no strokes, there's no deep vein thrombosis. So these bears are naturally anticoagulating themselves while they're hibernating. So we've done actually activated clotting times or ACT tests. In the summer, they have activated clotting times just like a human, which might be 70 seconds or 80 seconds or so. And then in the winter, their times will go up to 250 seconds long, which would be like someone that you've actually anticoagulated for doing a surgical procedure.
And they're doing this naturally.
And they're doing it naturally. Okay. So there's just all this amazing physiology we have a lot yet to learn from.
Dr. Izzo, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. You're welcome.
Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories is a podcast of the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery and is produced by Amanda Brower. Our audio tech is Brian Carnell. I'm medical historian David Korostyshevsky. Join us next time on Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories.